Okay, so I want to start with a premise today that sounds, well, it honestly sounds like it belongs in a science fiction movie, or maybe like a late night dorm room conversation.
I love those kinds of premises. Let's hear it.
Right, so the premise is that the world you see right now, the phone in your hand, or the coffee cup on the table, or even the walls of your room, none of that is actually out there.
Out there in the way we usually think about it, anyway.
Exactly. It's actually a construction project happening entirely inside your head. And if you stopped looking at it, it wouldn't exist in the way you think it does.
It sounds totally radical. It sounds like a pitch for the Matrix, honestly.
It really does.
Yeah.
But this is the absolute bedrock of modern philosophy, and it is the heart of the material we are diving into today.
Yes, we're heading back into Immanuel Kant and his critique of pure reason.
Which is a pretty massive mountain to climb. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. I'm your host, and sitting across from me is our resident expert to help us unpack this.
Glad to be here. And yeah, it is a mountain.
Today, specifically, we are looking at a section called the Transcendental Analytic. We are working off an amazing lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes that really breaks this down for us.
Those lectures are incredibly helpful.
They really are. And honestly, this is the point where Kant stops being just dry theory about space and time and starts actively messing with your sense of reality.
Completely. I mean, in our previous deep dive on the source material, we talked about the transcendental aesthetic.
Right, the space and time stuff.
Exactly, space and time. Kant called those the forms of intuition, but today we are moving past that into the engine room, so to speak, the understanding.
Right, because if space and time are just the canvas, the analytic is the painter. It's the machinery that turns all that raw noise into a world that actually makes sense.
Precisely. That is our mission today. We want to figure out how we turn raw noise, colors, sounds, physical sensations into coherent thoughts, like that is a chair or fire causes heat.
The setup here is this massive cage match between two big schools of thought at the time. You had the
Like
empiricists,
David Hume.
like Hume, right, who said, look, all we have is raw data. We just see stuff happen, and that's it. And then on the other side, you had the rationalists.
Right. And they said, no, we have these innate ideas born into us from the start.
Yeah, and Kant is basically about to walk into the ring and just smash these two opposing ideas together.
He really is. But to do that, he has to identify what he calls the universal structure of experience.
Right.
He's not interested in what you experience on a daily basis, but how you experience it, the universal rules.
So let's unpack this a bit. We have to start with this problem of what Kant calls blindness. He has this very famous maxim, percepts without concepts are blind.
Which is incredibly catchy.
It sounds great on a bumper sticker, but what does it actually mean for us?
Well, Dr. Holmes uses a really effective example in his lecture to illustrate this. So imagine I just point my finger at something and I say, blue patch now.
Okay, blue patch now.
Yeah.
What have I actually told you?
I mean, I guess you've told me there's something blue and it is happening right now. Have I, though? Or have I just made a random noise while pointing my finger?
Oh, I see what you mean.
Right, because for you to understand the word blue, you already need a concept of color. For you to understand the word now, you need a concept of time.
So if you strip away all those concepts, all that pre-installed software in your brain, and you just get the raw sensation hitting your retina, what is it?
Exactly what it is. It's just input.
That's just pure noise.
Yes, it's blind. You aren't interpreting it. You
Right.
aren't affirming anything about reality. If you just have the raw sensation of blue, but you lack the concept of sky or paint or even object, the sensation is entirely meaningless.
So raw data from the world just isn't enough. We need a sorting mechanism to make sense of it.
We need a conceptual framework. We need category.
Categories.
Right. Kant is arguing that for us to make any sense of the world, we absolutely need software running in our heads before we experience anything, just to organize that raw data.
And this is the big shift from the aesthetic to the analytic. The aesthetic part gave us space and time, meaning we see things in 3D and we feel them happen in a sequence.
Yes.
But the analytic gives us the categories to understand what we are actually seeing in that space and time.
Correct. And Kant is on a hunt here. He uses what he calls the transcendental method.
Which means what exactly?
It means he wants to bracket out all the specific details of your individual life, the fact that you're drinking coffee right now or sitting in a blue chair. He strips all the specific content away to find the universal structure that must be there for any human being to experience anything at all.
Okay, so he's basically looking for the source code of the human mind.
In a manner of speaking, yes.
But here is my question. You can't exactly open up a human brain and look for these categories. He is writing this stuff in the 1780s. How on earth does he find them?
Right. Well, he's definitely not doing neuroscience. And this is where his approach gets really interesting. Kant looks at logic.
Logic. Like formal logic.
Yes. He says, if we want to know how the mind classifies existence itself, let's look at how the mind classifies judgments.
Judgments. You mean like judging people?
No logical judgments.
Yeah.
Sentences. Statements about the world.
Okay.
If you open a standard logic textbook, even one from Kant's time, you'll see different structural ways we make statements. Like, all men are mortal. Or some men are tall. Or if X, then Y.
Right, the basic building blocks of an argument.
Exactly. And Kant argues that these logical structures aren't just arbitrary tricks of language. They actually mirror the fundamental categories of the human mind.
So he basically reverse engineers the human mind by looking at grammar and logic.
That is wild.
Essentially, yes. Okay. He figures if there is a fundamental way to structure a logical thought, there must be a corresponding category hardwired in the mind that allows us to think it in the first place.
Okay, that makes sense. And in the source material, Dr. Holmes points out that Kant finds 12 of these categories, right? Arranged in four groups of three.
Yes, four triads, 12 categories total. I don't want to get totally bogged down in a massive list, but let's run through the four main headlines just so we can see the overall shape of this mental architecture.
Sure. The first group is quantity. This covers unity, plurality, and totality. Basically dealing with one thing, many things, or all things.
Okay, that tracks quantity. Makes sense.
The second group is quality. This includes reality, negation, and limitation.
So, like, is something there? Is it not there?
Yeah.
Or is it there, but with limits?
Precisely. Then the third group is relation. And this is a really big one. This group contains substance and accident, cause and effect, and reciprocity.
Cause and effect is huge. We'll definitely come back to that.
Yeah.
And the fourth group?
Modality, which covers possibility, existence, and necessity. Could it be? Is it? Must it be?
Okay, I want to stop and double click on that relation group you mentioned.
Yeah.
Specifically the cause and effect part, because reading through Holmes's notes, this feels like the main event where Kant basically takes on David Hume.
It absolutely is the main event. Remember, Hume was a radical skeptic.
Right.
He argued that when you see one billiard ball hit another billiard ball, you don't actually see causation.
You just see ball A stop and ball B start moving.
Exactly. Hume basically said causation is just a mental habit. We feel like causation is real because we've seen things happen in sequence a lot, but we can't actually prove it's a real force out there in the universe.
And Kant's response to that is what?
Kant says no. Causation is not something we slowly learn from observing the world. Causation is a category hardwired into our brains from birth.
It's a lens.
It is a lens we must look through. We literally cannot experience the world except as a chain of causes and effects.
That is such a massive shift in perspective. He's saying we don't go out and discover that fire causes heat. Our brains are built in such a way that they demand that effects have causes.
Yes. And this leads to a very important distinction that Dr. Holmes highlights between Aristotle and Kant.
Because Aristotle had his own list of categories, right?
He did. But Aristotle thought his categories described how the universe actually is. He called them categories of being. Kant is saying, look, I don't know how the universe is in itself. These are categories of understanding. They only describe how human beings think.
Wow. Which brings us to a kind of scary implication for science, doesn't it?
It really does. Holmes points out that for Kant, Newtonian science, you know, physics, gravity, all of that isn't necessarily describing the objective reality outside of us.
Wait, so physics isn't real?
Well, it's real to us, but Kant is essentially an anti-realist about science in that sense. He believes science is just describing the internal structure of the human mind. Science tells us about the phenomena, the world exactly as it appears to human senses, not the ultimate reality behind the curtain.
That is, well, it's a lot to process. It makes science feel a little less deeply objective and a bit more human-centric.
It does.
But before we get to that reality behind the curtain, we really have to talk about how the mind actually stitches all this together.
The mechanism of it.
Right, because right now we have these abstract categories, these pure logic rules, and we have these raw, chaotic senses. But how do they combine to become a seamless movie?
This brings us to what Kant calls the threefold synthesis.
Right, the unity problem.
Exactly. Think about your senses for a minute. You have sight, sound, touch, smell. They're all completely separate channels. They're fragmented.
Yeah, they are just totally different types of data.
And they happen in these little discrete bursts of time. So the question Kant asks is, how do millions of fragmented sensory inputs become one single unified experience?
Right, because if I look at a coffee cup, I don't see a list of traits. I don't see white curve and feel warm sensation and smell roasted coffee as separate independent events. I just seamlessly experience cup.
Exactly. And to explain how we do that, Kant introduces a completely new definition for a very old word, imagination.
No, wait. When I hear the word imagination, I think of daydreaming or making up a story about a dragon or something.
And that was exactly the definition for earlier philosophers like Locke and Hobbes. They thought imagination was just memory or calling up faded mental pictures.
So what is Kant's upgrade?
For Kant, imagination isn't fantasy at all. It's the heavy lifting crew of the human mind. It's an active, powerful force that actually stitches the raw data of the world together in real time.
Stitches it how, though?
Well, Dr. Holmes breaks it down into three steps of synthesis: apprehension, reproduction, and recognition.
Okay.
Apprehension is just grasping the raw data in a single moment. Recognition is finally applying a concept to it so you know what it is. But the middle step, the one I want to really focus on, is reproduction.
Why focus on reproduction?
Because human experience happens in time. A moment passes, and the second you just lived is gone forever.
Right. Time never stops.
So if your mind couldn't reproduce or hold on to that past second while simultaneously experiencing a current second, you wouldn't have a seamless movie of reality.
You'd just have a strobe light.
Exactly. Flashing, disconnected images. You'd never hear a melody. You would just hear single, isolated notes that instantly vanish.
So the imagination is essentially like the buffer on a streaming video. It keeps the previous frames readily available so the current video flows perfectly smooth.
That is a perfect analogy. It synthesizes the fragments into a continuous flow. But then Holmes asks the really big question here. Who is running the computer? Who's actually doing all this synthesizing?
The eye.
The eye. But not just any eye. Kant calls this the transcendental unity of apperception.
Okay, that is definitely the most German philosophical phrase I have ever heard.
It is a mouthful, I know. But it's crucial. Contrast it with someone like Descartes. Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." He thought the eye was a literal thing, a soul substance sitting inside you.
And Hume.
Hume said, "There is no eye at all. When I look inside, I just find a bundle of random perceptions."
Okay, so what is Kant's middle ground?
Kant says the eye is the thing that ties the bundle together.
Oh,
the eye isn't a physical soul you can find in biology. It is the function of unity itself. I'm the unity of my experience. I create my own unity by actively synthesizing the world around me.
That sounds almost, I don't know, existential. Like I'm not a static thing. I'm an ongoing act of creation.
Holmes actually explicitly mentions that connection.
Yeah.
He points out that Sartre's famous idea that I create myself owes a massive debt to Kant. The eye isn't an object you can find. It's an active unifier.
Okay, so we have the categories representing the logic side, and we have the synthesis representing the processing side. But there's still a gap here. In the lecture, Dr. Holmes talks about something called the schematism. And honestly, this part made my head hurt a little bit trying to follow it.
Don't worry, it's widely considered the trickiest part of the entire book, but it is essential to making his system work.
Okay, walk me through it.
Here is the core problem. The categories, things like causality or substance, are purely abstract thoughts. They're pure, pristine logic.
Right.
But our sensations, a red color, a loud bang, a soft texture, those are concrete and physical. They're totally different substances, essentially. So how do they ever touch? How does pure logic grab onto a physical sensation?
It sounds like the mind-body problem all over again. Like, how does the ghost talk to the machine?
Exactly. That's the perfect way to phrase it. Descartes tried to solve the mind-body problem with the pineal gland in the brain, which Holmes hilariously calls a goof.
Total goof, yeah.
But Kant solves his version of this problem with time.
Wait, why time?
Because time is the only thing common to both the outside physical world and the inside mental world.
Oh, I see.
We perceive physical things happening in sequence in the outside world that's outer sense, and our own thoughts also happen in a sequence in our mind that's inner sense. Both run on the track of time, so time is the bridge.
So a schema is basically a way of translating a pure category into terms of time.
Precisely. A schema is a rule involving time.
Can you give me an example of how that works?
Let's take the category of substance. Substance as a category is just an abstract logical idea. But the schema of substance, the translation, is permanence in time.
Meaning that?
Meaning if something stays the same while time continuously passes around it, our brain's rule flags it and says, ah, that is a substance.
Oh, okay. And what about cause and effect?
The abstract category is causality. The schema is succession in time. The strict rule is that event A is always inevitably followed by event B. When the mind sees that specific temporal pattern succession, it applies the category of causality.
So the schema is literally like a translation layer. It takes the logical rule and it constantly checks the timeline of our senses to see if the rule applies.
Yes. Holmes notes that a schema isn't a picture in your head. It's a rule. It's like having the mathematical rule for constructing a triangle, rather than just holding a picture of one specific triangle in your mind.
I think I get it. We've built a machine now. We have the categories, the synthesis, the schematism. Now we really have to talk about the final output, the world we actually see and walk around in.
Which leads us right to the massive distinction between phenomena and noumena.
The climax of the analytic.
It is. And it uses one of Dr. Holmes's absolute best analogies to explain it, the ice cube tray.
I love this analogy so much. It was the moment the whole book finally clicked for me. Break it down for everyone.
All right. Imagine your mind is an empty ice cube tray. Reality, the pure, raw input from the universe itself is just water. And the water flows into the tray.
Okay, water goes in.
Now, the tray has a very rigid structure. It has all these little square compartments. Those compartments represent the categories.
Right.
When the water flows in, it must take the shape of the tray. You absolutely cannot get the water without getting the shape of the tray.
So the ice cubes that pop out are the phenomena.
Yes. The ice cubes are the world exactly as it appears to human beings. In German, Kant calls it the Ding für mich, the thing for me.
And the water before it freezes.
The free-flowing water before it ever hits the tray is the noumena, the ding and such the thing in itself.
And Kant's entire point with this is that we can never, ever know the water without the tray.
Never. We are permanently trapped in our own way of knowing. We can never see the universe naked. We only ever see it through the rigid lens of space, time, and the categories.
You know, this is the part that deeply unnerves me.
That's
because if that is really true, then what on earth is science actually doing? If we are spending billions of dollars studying physics and astronomy, aren't we studying the universe?
Kant would say no. You are studying the ice cubes. You're just studying the structure of the human mind perfectly reflected back at you.
That is such a heavy claim. It basically says we can never really know what is out there.
We can logically know that it exists. The water has to come from somewhere, but we can't know its true nature.
Right.
But here is the flip side of that unnerving feeling.
Yeah.
And this is what Kant famously calls his Copernican Revolution.
Oh, yeah. The astronomy reference.
Right. Copernicus flipped astronomy upside down by saying the sun doesn't orbit the Earth orbits the sun. Kant does the exact same thing to philosophy.
How?
He says it is not that our knowledge must conform to objects in the world. It is that objects in the world must conform to our knowledge, to our mental structure, just to be experienced at all.
That is the real mind bender for me. The chair I'm looking at right now across the room, he has to follow the rules of my mind just to exist for me.
Yes. Nature itself, the physical laws of physics, the predictable order we see in chemistry, none of that is out there in the chaotic thing in itself.
Wow.
Nature is just the ordered, unified phenomena that our minds are constantly creating. We build nature.
So when I sit on a beach and look at a beautiful sunset, I'm not just a passive camera recording the light. I'm actually actively building the sunset.
You are a vital participant in its creation.
So Dr. Holmes mentions this whole setup leads to something called the egocentric predicament.
Or perhaps we should call it the category-centric.
Right, because it's not about my ego, it's about my human hardware.
Exactly. The predicament is that we cannot know anything without the eye being heavily involved.
Uh-huh.
We are always looking through our own human-tinted glasses, and we literally cannot take them off to see if they are distorting the view.
We're stuck inside the helmet.
We are.
So what does this all mean for us at the end of the day? Why does this matter, beyond just being a really cool late-night thought experiment?
It matters deeply because it sets the strict limits of human knowledge. That is the whole reason Kant wrote this massive book. He wants to save the validity of science, but he wants to firmly limit the reach of metaphysics.
Limit metaphysics how?
Well, we can do science reliably because science studies the ice cubes, the phenomena.
Right, the stuff in the tray.
Yes. We can measure phenomena, we can predict them, because they strictly follow the rules of our own mind, like cause and effect, time and space.
But metaphysics, like talking about God or the soul or the origin of the universe?
Those things, God, the immortal soul, the universe as complete whole, they are not sensory inputs. They aren't water flowing into the physical tray. They are pure ideas.
Oh.
And remember the rule from the very beginning, concepts without percepts are empty.
Right. So we can't legitimately use the categories on something like God.
Exactly. You can't logically ask a question like, what caused God? Because causality is strictly a rule for organizing sensory experience. It's not a magic wand you can wave at things outside of space and time.
That is fascinating.
Kant is saying we can't logically prove God exists using philosophical proofs, but by that exact same token, we also cannot disprove him. Those massive questions just fall completely outside the bounds of what the human mind software is capable of processing.
We literally just don't have the hardware or software for it.
Precisely. We are forever limited to the island of our own experience. The vast ocean of the noumena surrounds us on all sides, but we simply do not have a boat to sail on it.
It's incredibly humbling, honestly, because for all our advanced science and complex logic, we're ultimately just describing the inside of our own helmets with better and better math.
In a way, yes. But look, it's also profoundly empowering if you think about it. It means the beautiful order and structure we see in the world, we actually contribute that. We are active participants in reality, not just passive spectators waiting for things to happen to us.
It really changes how you look at something as simple as a coffee mug. Or someone pointing at a blue patch now.
It certainly does. The world you experience is a real-time co-production between the hidden universe and you.
Well, here is a final thought to leave you with today. If Kant is right, and nature itself is just the sum of appearances constructed by the human mind, does that fundamentally mean we are in a very real sense the authors of the laws of nature? Are we the ones unconsciously telling the universe exactly how to behave simply by the act of observing it?
That is a deeply provocative thought indeed.
Definitely something to chew on next time you see a billiard ball, hit another billiard ball, and wonder why it moves. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
Until next time.